Now it is time for the leader to qualify. Please stand when sharing. Okay. So all may hear and see. Okay. We ask you to keep the focus on your recovery in this 12-step program, Overeaters Anonymous. And I qualify for 9:15. Okay. Okay. Because of my own personal reasons, I am not going to use my own name, my real name. So I'm going to use, CJ. So I'm CJ, compulsive overeater. Wait a minute.
Hi, CJ.
Hi, everyone. I want to thank Diane for asking me to come and share. I have no idea what I'm going to say. I'm just going to ask God to speak through me. When I first came in here, I had, I guess, no self-esteem, and then I kind of graduated to low self-esteem. And because I still suffer from the disease, the ism, I get self-centered. It's kind of like in the big book when it talks about page 62, like selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear and self-delusion and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. So because I'm still into my selfish ways, I feel like because you guys are all looking at me, you're all judging me, and you're not going to accept me. And my main thing in life is I always just wanted to fit in. I always wanted to just be a part of, and I always wanted to just be accepted. And I never felt that. I never felt I was good enough, smart enough, pretty enough, thin enough. I just felt I wasn't enough across the board. And I was instead of being a human being, I was a human doer. So I thought I had to do and produce in order to be okay. Because if I didn't excel, if I didn't produce, if I didn't be the best at whatever I tried to achieve, I was less than, I was unworthy, I was unwanted and unloved. And basically that's how I came in here. I had a lot of guilt. No, that's not true. It was more shame, because I heard somebody say this. They said the difference between guilt and shame is guilt is I made a mistake. I dropped the glasses. I'm guilty. But shame is that I am the mistake. And I always felt that I'm a mistake. And I had to change my, my belief system, because as long as I believed my head, which will tell me a lot of negative stuff, it's a very bad neighborhood for me, is that I'm not going to be, happy, joyous, and free. I'm not going to feel comfortable in my own skin. And that's basically what I want to be, is feeling like I can just stand here or sit there and just be, I can just be and feel at ease. And I never felt that. So the first thing I did when I was little, let me just go back one second. When I was four, my parents divorced, which today, as an adult grown woman, I know has nothing to do with me. But back at four, I thought, well, it must be my fault, because there's only one here is me, because I'm so self-centered, right? That egomaniac with that, you know, the inferiority complex. So I thought, well, it must be something I did to cause that. It must be because I'm not good enough. I must be a bad little girl. Why would my daddy, who I love, why would he go away? I must be so inherently flawed and bad that he can't even stand to be with me. So as long as I believe those thoughts, I'm not happy. I'm not joyous, and I'm not free, and I'm not content. And they talk about in the book, I'm restless and I'm irritable and discontent. So what I did with the feelings, which I didn't have any tools on how to cope with my feelings. I didn't know how to deal with when I'm feeling anger, or when I'm feeling anxiety, or any feeling, fear. I didn't know how to deal with those feelings, and I feel on a very deep level. For some reason, God created me where I'm very emotional, and I'm very intense, and I just like feel it all. So I didn't know what to do with those feelings. So my first thing that I did to check out and alter the way I was feeling was I would start controlling my environment. So here's mom and dad. They divorce. I'm 4. My brother's 6. And I'm thinking it's something I did. I am so self-centered that I think I am so powerful and so grandiose that I could have caused them to divorce, right? It's all me. So what I did was to feel somewhat safer was I started controlling my environment. So when I was little, like all my dolls would be lined up, all my stuffed animals, everything would be in order. And it's like if you were to come in my room and make it like this, I'd be like, it would just like cause such anxiety. So I'd have to like straighten it out and make everything like all perfect. Because right, if I get perfect, then maybe daddy will come back then. So that was the first thing that I did to alter my my feelings. And then I got involved in a very rigid, very perfectionist, competitive sport. And I did that sport really full on. Like I'm state champion of California in 1975. You know, I'm like, I'm not just going to do it for the fun of the sport. I'm going to be in the gym like 5 hours a day, and I'm going to be like, you know, pointing my toes and just focused on that, because when I did that, it was like a horse with blinders on, and I couldn't see or feel any of the craziness that's going on out here in my family, which was very chaotic. All I could do was focus on this, and I had a great deal of focus and intensity. So I was able to channel that energy into that sport, and I was ended up to be very successful because I competed state, regionally, national. And the long-range goal was to make the Olympics. And there was I grew up in this area. There was articles back then. They had the Beverly Hills Courier, Beverly Hills Post, and Beverly Hills Independent newspaper. And they put in, you know, watch out, so-and-so, here comes the next Olympic hopeful. And they put in my name. And I felt very pressured. Like, I've got to perform. I've got to succeed. I've got to step up. And the truth of the matter was I wasn't good enough. And I didn't make the Olympics. And I felt like I was a failure. I thought, you know, state champion, that's just not good enough. That is just not good enough. And I still feel like that. I still feel like, well, you should have been better, you know. And so what happened for me was all these feelings started to... There's something in my back that's itching, so I don't mean to like always go like this, but digging into my back. Anyway, so what happened for me was these feelings started to surface. And all of a sudden I started feeling scared and anxious and very lonely and depressed. And I didn't have any coping skills. I didn't see how to have healthy relationships. I didn't see how to interact. You know, I didn't know how to like have a conversation. Like, hi, Diane, how you doing? Jack, I mean, I could not socially connect. And it was very painful because inside, I wanted to connect, I wanted intimacy, and I wanted to have people in my life, but I was just so afraid that you weren't going to accept me, so I had to like pull away, I had to like put a wall up. And the first thing I used was food. And I discovered that when I ate, and usually it was something, I did this weird like, what do you want to call it, what do I want to call it? Like chemistry. Like I would eat something really sugary. Like let's say I had a big banana split, and then it was like then some donuts, you know. And I never had just one donut. It was like a dozen donuts. You know, I was a volume eater, and so you know I'd eat that, and then it tasted so sweet. So then I'm like, now I need something kind of salty to counter it, you know. So then I need like you know potato chips or fries or something, and I kind of did the sweet and sour thing. You know, that was my binges. I never really binged on healthy food. Like I only binged on like you know things that were sugary and sweet, and they made me feel good. It was basically like a drug. And I noticed when I ate, all of a sudden it squelched the feelings. All of a sudden it was like, I can breathe. All is right with the world now. I don't feel as anxious or as lonely or as scared or as depressed. And it basically checked me out. It basically numbed me out. But what I discovered in doing that kind of eating, I gained weight. I got fat, yeah. And I put on about 45 pounds in 2 months. And my older brother was not that kind about it. So he called me Lardo. Look at my sister, Lardo, Lardo. And it was very hurtful. And I had no clothes to wear because I outgrew all my clothes. And my mom would not buy me new clothes. So I wear my brother's big clothes. And she said, you cannot wear your brother's clothes. Why are you wearing your brother's clothes? Those are his. And I'm thinking, lady, you didn't buy me any new clothes. What am I supposed to wear, you know? And then I'd see people that I knew from school, and they were very cruel. They remember me very thin. And now all of a sudden they see me 45 pounds heavier. So they'd come up to me and they'd go, oh my God, you got so fat. How'd you gain all that weight? And I wanted to smack them in the face because how the hell do you think I gained all that weight? Really? Like, I didn't just wake up one day and had 45 pounds more on my body. I consumed a lot of food and I was eating. I was eating my emotions. So what I started to do was, to avoid that, is I wear my mother's big overcoat, like a big raincoat, a trench coat, and then I thought I was hiding the fat. I thought I could hide that 45 pounds. And then when, even though my face, I gain it everywhere, so every, you know, even if I'm hiding in a raincoat, the face is still fuller. You could see, anyway. So when I'd see people that I knew from high school, I would hide behind a tree or a telephone pole. Because I'm like, oh no, there comes Jack. I gotta hide, you know. And I'd hide thinking like, now they can't see me, so no one's going to comment on like, weren't you really thin in high school? You were that one that was that competitive. How'd you get so fat? And it was constant. And I was so tormented, and it was so hurtful. And it took it as my identity. And then I had a mother that wasn't all that loving at times. She's a very loving mother now at 87, but not back then always. So she said to me, you have no waist. You're like a sausage. And I'm like, what does that even mean? But and then I met a girlfriend. She was a binge buddy, and she taught me how to binge around the city. And so, you know, back in the 70s, they had, Famous Amos up on Sunset, and they had Pioneer Chicken, and I'd go from place to place to place and just, like, be binging, and then I'd be so stuffed, I could barely move. I looked in the mirror, and I was like, whoa, I look 9 months pregnant. And I said, Susie, I'm in a lot of pain. I can't breathe. And it felt like a knife stabbing my stomach. And she says, well, you know what? Just put your finger down your throat and then get rid of it. I'm like, oh, okay. So then I tried that and nothing came up but like spit, like saliva. I'm like, I can't get it. How do you get it up? Like, what? Nothing's coming up for me. And she says, you just got to practice. You just got to push on. And I'm like, no, it's not working for me. Honey, I'm sorry, but it just doesn't work. And so what happened was I looked at my older brother, who I admired, and I thought, wow, well, he's really skinny. He's also a heroin addict. That's the answer. So I made the connection of you do, and then I thought about all these musicians, the rock and rollers, like, I don't know, Alice Cooper, all that Rolling Stones, they're all super skinny. But what do? They do a lot of drugs. So I thought, that's my solution. That is my answer. If I do a lot of drugs, then I can be thin again. And so I got into doing heroin. And it helped me throw up. Because the first... it's just my story. But no. Because I first started with smoking opium. Met this Persian guy. He introduced me to the opium. We started smoking the opium. on the tinfoil, and it made me nauseous. It made me vomit, and I thought, well, this is good. I can eat. And then it gets out, and it was like so easy. So I did that. And then he graduated from the opium to the heroin. So, you don't have to always like shoot it. You can snort it. You can smoke it. Because I really wasn't into the needle thing. And my brother OD'd. He died. So I didn't want to, I didn't want to do that. So, yeah, that's the way it was, Carol. Where was I? So then that helped me with the bulimia. I did that for 30 years before I could get abstinent. It took me a long time to get abstinent. I just, anything I ever let go of had like claw marks. I'm not going to let go of it till I, get the last drop out of it. So the second husband I was on was in the mid-80s, and he noticed I was like eating this huge amount of food, and then I'd like get rid of it. And he said, our marriage is not working here. He says, you're like choosing your food over the marriage. And he's like, I can't deal with this. He's like, I'm going to put you in the hospital. So 1984, he put me into a eating disorder facility. And you know when they say this program is for people who, it's not for people who need it. It's people who want it. I didn't want it. So in 1984, they introduced me to OA. They brought panels in through hospital institutions. They, brought the 12 steps in, and they said, you get a sponsor, you work the program. And I'm like, I don't want any of this. I want to eat, and I want to be left alone, I just need my drug. And so I had no desire to be in this program, And so I continued on that path of the drinking and the drugging and the alcohol. And then I finally just stopped the drinking because it was too high calorically. I thought, I'm not going to drink my calories. I'd rather eat the cake and the donut and the pizza and the taco, and then I'm going to actually, do the heroin because that really makes me feel good. It really numbs me out because I can't stand what I'm feeling. It's like someone threw like battery acid on me, I'm burning. I can't stand this feeling. I want to rip my skin off. There's like red ants crawling on me. It was like a horrible sensation. And the food and the drugs took it away. So, 1991, 24 years ago, I came into AA and I got sober. And what happened when I got sober was I gained 45 pounds in my first 60 days of sobriety. So I don't know what that is about 45 pounds in 2 months, but that's my, that's been my experience. So, and then I had the sponsor. I said, look at me, I'm 45 pounds heavier. And she says, don't worry about the weight. The weight will come off. Just stay sober. You're not going to die from the food, but, you will from the drugs. Just stay sober. So I was like, okay. And I started going to OA. And the first OA meeting I remember going to, it was at the log cabin, 1991, and there was a redhead woman there that I see now still in program, and she's no longer red hair. She's older like I am. But I came in eating Air Pop popcorn. And I could not eat. So I'm sitting there and I'm popping this Air Pop popcorn, and she says, "You can't eat in here." And I said, "No, it's Air Pop. It's that great." And she says, "No, but this is Overeaters Anonymous. You're not allowed to eat in here." And I was so furious at her. I said, "How dare?" I was very arrogant. "How dare she tell me I can't eat? I can't sit in that seat without eating, and it's Air Pop, so there's hardly any calories." So I left that meeting, and because the log cabin was not too far from Pink's, I went to Pink's. Then I hit the Winchell's, and there was a Baskin Robbins, and Cantor's, and the bakery's there, and I'm just like, I'm shoveling it in just to like squelch that, and screw her, how dare she tell me not to eat. And also I was a little confused because in AA all you do is eat there. There's donuts there, right? There's tons of coffee. There's like the cakes. I could take the cakes home if someone didn't want it. It's just like, there's a one meeting that has like chips and food. I mean, it would be food galore, So I didn't understand, was she just controlling me? Is she kind of like my mom? Why is she telling me I can't eat? Because I don't know how not to. That's what I do to survive. So I left OA. I just really didn't get it. I just thought, you know what? I think what's going to happen for me is I have to accept the fact that God is going to just remove that obsession with the drugs, and he's not going to remove the food obsession, because I was still obsessed with food up until 16 years of sobriety. And I was like, okay, God, I don't really get this. You remove the obsession with drugs, but you have alcohol, but you haven't removed it with the food. I'm still like constantly thinking about food, and it's going on and on in my head. And I thought, okay, maybe that's the best it's going to be for me. And I kind of came to terms with, this is how I cope with life. This is how I get through the world, is by compulsively overeating and coating my nerves with food. And I kind of just said, I guess that's how it's going to be. Because after 30 years of doing that, I thought, there's no hope for me. And I got a little bit, you know, resentful at people in OA. They're like, oh, I'm so grateful I'm abstinent. I'm so grateful I don't have my head in the toilet. I'm so grateful I have a life and I'm present. And I'm like, I don't have that. I want that. I mean, yeah, I'm free off of the drugs. And then this is it. Did I hear a timer, Carol?
You missed it. You have just a minute.
Okay. So then this woman in ACE, she said to me, you know what, you're not really sober. And I said, what are you talking about? And I was about 5 years sober at the time. And she said, well, you're sober off your drugs and your alcohol, but you're using food as a drug. And I really got rigorously honest, and I did a little soul searching, and I realized, oh, she's right. As long as I eat, I'm drugged. I'm numbed. I'm looking through cheesecloth. I'm no longer present. I'm like, you know. So I had to come back to OA after another hospitalization, and I had to really like throw myself into this program, and I had to realize this program works because I had experience that it worked in my AA program. So I thought, well, it's going to work for OA. I must be doing something wrong because it wasn't working for me. So I had to start doing things differently. And like that thing when it says, if you keep doing the same thing, you're going to keep getting the same thing. So I had to start doing things differently. Now that's my five. Oh, that's the done. Okay. So now I open it up for questions. Yes?
Yeah, it says.
Oh, it says. I'm sorry. Okay. This is time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. No, I already took it. What are you doing? God, Michael. That's my change. Okay, at this time, at this time for questions only, there is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and do not and are not of those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking a question, you don't need to identify yourself. And please remember, if you do ask a question, your voice may be audible on the OA podcast. And I need to restate the question after it's asked. Okay, and who would like to begin? Oh, I have to stand. Okay. Diane's like the director. Diane!
Thank you so much for your story. I really appreciate your honesty in the story. Can you talk about, I feel like we left it that you came in the door, we're about to come in the door. Could you talk about how you work the steps in this program?
Okay.
Repeat the question.
Okay, the question was, how do I work the steps in this program? Okay, the way I work the steps in this program is, I discovered that for me, I have to do it daily. Like the first time I went through the steps, I thought, well, you just do them once and that's it. Like then you're like done. And I didn't realize until years later that this is a way of life. Like I have to incorporate this type of lifestyle into my life and into the world and the way I behave. So I have to every day realize not only am I powerless over food and drugs and alcohol, but people, my mother, my son, the traffic in LA, you know, if I get fired, if I get hired, I'm powerless over basically everything. Like if there's an earthquake right now, I don't have any power. So I have to completely remind myself of that. And then I have to know that in depending on my own resources, my life can be very unmanageable. And I can get very uncomfortable when I rely on self. So then I realize, oh, there is a second step. The solution is there's a power that is greater than me that will restore me to sanity. And the way I ate is pretty insane. You know, who eats like whole pizzas and whole cakes? You know, that's just not a normal type of eating. So that's pretty insane. I had insane thinking. And I still do. And the book tells me it's a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. So I have to keep that in check. I have to go to meetings. I have to turn my will and life over to God. And I forget that. Sometimes I think, well, I got this. Things are good. I'm running the show. I'm driving the... And it's like, no, I need to turn my will and my life over to God, because when I do that, things go better. Because then I'm not into like that self-will run riot, you know? And, you know, when I did my fourth step, I do now a tenth, which is a kind of a mini fourth, where I continue to look at what's my part. Like, where am I being selfish? Where am I being dishonest? Where am I in fear? Like, oh my God, fear runs my life, you know? And it's self-centered fear. It's fear of losing what I have, or fear of not getting what I want. And, so that's really helpful for me to remember. And then, you know, and it took me a long time to do 6 and 7, because part of my disease is I have denial. So I thought, well, I don't really have that many character defects. I don't really need God to take anything from me. But then over the years, I realized, no, I can be pretty selfish. I can be pretty self-centered. I can be thinking about me, and dishonest or in fear, you know, fear, again, the old fears. I'm not good enough. You're not going to like me. I don't fit in. I don't matter. I don't have any worth. I have no value. And that's actually not only my fear, but it's also dishonest, because I do have value. I'm a child of God, and I have value, and I have worth, and I am a contributing member to society, and I do make a difference, even though I believed I never did. That's 6 and 7. I have to like ask those to be removed. And what I recently started doing is I started praying on a daily basis in my meditation, the 7-step prayer and the 3rd-step prayer. And, so I just kind of tell, okay, my Creator, you know, please have all of me, the good and the bad. Take every single defect of character away from me and you know, help me to be of service. And then I do 10th one I mentioned. 11th, it's interesting because it was only recently that I discovered the 11th step says, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact for God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us. I didn't see that part for many years, probably a couple of decades. I didn't realize I could just pray for what I want, what I need in my life. But I didn't realize, no, I'm supposed to pray for God's will for me and the power to carry it out, because I wanted to pray for things to work out my way. And the way my brain works is, if you guys only do it my way, then I'll be okay. Like, if you stay put and you do this over here and you do that, then everything's fine. I'll be okay. But if you do it wrong, then I'm not okay. So I had to really get into those steps and really like make them a part of me. And I hope that answered your question. Carol. I'm sorry?
Do you have resentments?
Okay, do I still have resentments? Sorry? Do I still have resentments? And if I do, how do I deal with them? Then the answer to that question is absolutely yes. I still have resentments. Kind of like, you know, what I said earlier, the risk of being redundant is that, you know, if anything I ever let go of has claw marks in it. So there's a lot of issues that I had growing up that had to do with my mother, and I still sometimes like cling to them, and I don't want to let go of them, and I have this like blame mentality still, even though I'm like working on changing that. I'll have it like, well, if only she did it differently, then I would be okay, and you know, she needs to change her behavior and who she is and the way she's acting so that I can feel safe and secure and that I can feel okay. And the truth of the matter is that's very selfish, because she, whoever she is, she's, I'm not going to change her at 87. Hell no. So I have to kind of accept her. I have to learn to accept life on life's terms. I do the prayer, like, I pray for her to have health and happiness and prosperity. I do the 4-step prayer on page don't know what it is, 67 or something, where though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturb us, they, like ourselves, are sick too. I mean, she's spiritually sick. And I asked God to show me the same patience and tolerance and love that I would cheerfully grant to a sick friend. And I can't always do that. Because even though when I'm saying those words, I feel like I'm just saying the words. Like, I don't really want her to have, you know, these things. I feel like I'm just saying lip service. But somehow in doing it, you know, it changes it. And I still have them, yeah. I'm still a work in progress, you know. Check.
When first you started abstaining, you got your food in order, how did you initially learn to sit with those feelings that you described so well as being just unbearable?
Okay, that's a very good question. The question was, when I first got abstinent, how did I learn how to sit through those feelings that I described earlier as being so unbearable?
That you described so well as being unbearable.
That I described so well
as being recorded.
Huh? What's that?
Okay.
Well, I think John said it was. So anyway, yeah, that's a good question because it was really, really hard for me. I think the hardest thing that I have ever done in my life is to sit through those feelings. Harder than becoming state champion in my sport, harder than giving up heroin, harder than losing my brother, losing my father. I was like, that's the hardest thing. Is like, I'm going to have to sit with these feelings that I cannot tolerate. And I'm sorry? You're just what?
Talking to yourself.
Oh, okay, you're talking to yourself. It's distracting. Okay, so I had to learn to say, well, there was one woman I remember that helped me early on in sobriety. She said, "You know," I said, "I can't take these feelings. I can't. I gotta get something in me. I can't handle this. I'm my skin is crawling. I just like somebody just threw acid on me. I can't take it. I'm gonna go high. I gotta alter the way I'm feeling because I'm really restless and irritable and discontent. I need to alter how I'm feeling. Like I think it's that ease and comfort. So what I make outreach calls and she'd say, gonna pass. I promise you it's gonna pass. And I would be like this little girl, no, I can't, it's not, you know, and she'd say, I promise you it'll pass. And I'm like, you promise? I could not, I didn't, you know. So I learned, oh, you get through it. And it doesn't, I used to think they're gonna kill me, number one. And number two, I used to think that they're gonna last forever. That this is how I'm going to feel for the rest of my life, and I can't stand this feeling, so I need something to take the edge off. But then I learned over time to get comfortable with being uncomfortable and to sit through the feelings, and that the more I do it, the easier it gets the next time. And they do pass. Anyone else?
Thank you, CJ. What do you do today when feelings come up?
What do I do today when feelings come up? The same thing. I'll make an outreach call, which you guys remind me when I get amnesia that this too will pass, that I have to sit through the uncomfortable feeling. It will not kill me, even though I think it will. It will not last forever, even though I think it will. And I will get stronger if I'm able to sit through it. So then the next time it happens, I'm not as devastated by it. It's kind of like if you're standing in the ocean and a big wave comes and it knocks you down. And the wind is knocked out of you. But then you get up and you're like, wow, that was really hard. That was really scary. And then the next time it comes, maybe I'm just knocked down to my, you know, knees. And then the next time, oh, I'm actually still standing. I'm a little wobbly, but I'm still standing. And then I realize, okay, the waves are going to come. That's just life. And I have to learn how to sit through the discomfort and know that feelings are part of being human. And the way I was, I always wanted to feel the good feelings. I wanted to be Disneyland all the time. And hearts and rainbows and, you know, unicorns and flowers. And that's not reality. Life has ups and downs and good and bad and peaks and valleys, highs and lows. And sometimes I'm feeling down. Sometimes I'm feeling angry. Sometimes I'm feeling lonely or scared. And I know they will pass. So I have to remember, this too shall pass. And I also really remind myself that I have to learn to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I never want to be uncomfortable. I want to feel good all the time.
What I meant was, what other tools do you use besides the book?
Okay, so now there's a beeper and you're asking another question, so how do I deal with that one?
Are we done, Carol?
We have 5 minutes.
I have 5 minutes, okay. Can you repeat the question, please?
What tools other than outreach, are there tools other than outreach that you use when feelings come up?
The ones I just described are the tools that I use.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. I don't have any other, yeah.
How you came into your abstinence and how you define it?
How I came into my abstinence and how I define it? When you say came into it, what exactly?
Led to it. Were you struck or?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I wasn't struck. That's a good question. The question is, how did I come into my abstinence and how do I define it? Okay, so the way I came into my abstinence was not struck abstinent. That's like really amazing to me, and it really mind boggles me when people say, I was just struck abstinent. I walked into OA and I just, it was like, that was not my experience. Because I came in and out for years and could not get abstinent. And so I would sit in a meeting and I would be obsessed with the food. Sometimes I couldn't even sit through the meeting and I'd have to go leave and head to the bakery. So was not struck abstinent, but and it came out very gradually. So when I first started to get abstinent, the most I could get would be about, I want to say about 4 or 5 days, and then I'd be at the donut. Then I'd be like in the food frenzy, you know, putting myself in a food coma. And I had a very loving, gentle sponsor then, and she said, "Well, you know, maybe this is the best you can do right now. Maybe all you can do is 4 or 5 days. And just be gentle with yourself. And that it's not going to be like that forever. It will shift." And it did. Over time, all of a sudden those days turned into like, you know, 6 days, seven, a week, a month, a year, you know, and it started to gradually accumulate. And then I also learned that the more I'm able to sit through those uncomfortable feelings and stay absent and not pick up, I'm able to deal with it. So I had to, it's like building a muscle. I had to get that muscle stronger. And the way I define my abstinence is I kind of do more of an intuitive eating. Like I don't, because I have a tendency from my upbringing and my past to be kind of controlling and rigid because I'm completely control freak. So, so yeah, I have to let it be like loose, like a loose garment, like let it be easy breezy. So it's like I kind of tune into my body. I'll take a deep breath. Like, what, am I hungry, or is this emotional hunger? Am I upset? Do I want to eat and squelch the feeling, or is it more out of the physiological hunger? And I do basically 3 meals a day. Sometimes I eat 4 if I feel hungry, because I'm like, wait. Are you still hungry? And I'm like, yeah, I think I am. Maybe I need to eat another, you know. And I do, but I eat very clean. I do not eat sugar. I do eat bread. I don't eat the bread basket thing at the restaurants, but I'll eat, you know, Ezekiel bread every morning. I'll do pasta. I'll do brown rice. I do brown rice daily. Because if I don't give myself those foods, I feel deprived. I feel like, well, aren't I really a good girl? Why can't I have those foods too? And then I get, you know, in a mindset where I set myself up to wanting to really have it. So I allow myself to have food that tastes yummy and good, so I don't feel like I'm being deprived. Because I did abstinence before where I was really restricting and felt deprived, and then I would just end up like, you know, eating a lot of food. So did that answer, or do you want me to elaborate more? That's good? Okay. How are we doing on time? Okay, 1 minute. Michael!
Your higher power today, how do you get comfort from your higher power rather than
the food? Ah, very good question. Michael asked, how do I get comfort from my higher power rather than the food? There's times when I can do a breathing technique that quiets my mind, that connects me to my higher source. It's like an internal thing, and it's like a sensation that I can feel that there is some force that is protecting me, guiding me, and that I'm okay. And when I have that, it's like having a big batch of brownies, you know. But the problem for me is I don't always have that, because sometimes I'm really plugged into God, and then other times it's fleeting, and it's like, wait, where are you, God? And like they always say, if you don't feel God, who moved? He didn't. So I have to realize you need to get back. Like, no one can control the thoughts of my mind, only I can. So I need to get back to, oh, I am not aligned with God. I need to get back to God. And the meditation I do daily helps. It took me a long time to meditate. I was about over 10 years sober before I could even meditate and just sit, because I could not sit still. So I hope that answered. I guess that's it, right?